allow me to give you a little context into the story that we're going to look this morning, and then I'll tell you what my title is. If you follow us on social media, I'm pretty sure you already know what the title is. The story is quite an interesting one, let me tell you. It's got everything that you need to make this dramatic. It's got armies. It's got refugees. It's got spies. It's got a prostitute. It's got a chase and an epic escape, right? All the drama one needs to put it in a proper blockbuster movie, which I'm sure would have taken the box office by storm. Trust me, this story is found in the Old Testament, the part of the Bible before Jesus came on earth, right? It is a book called Joshua. For those of us who've seen this recent movie, Exodus, Gods and Kings, have you seen that movie? Or the old classic Ten Commandments, won a few Oscars, 4-hour long movie, an old movie. This passage is actually found right after when Moses leads the Exodus out of Egypt, when Israel, God's chosen nation, were taken as slaves. They've served there, and Moses, the leader, actually goes and saves them with the help of God. And this passage is after he saves them. They spent 40 years in the wilderness, and they are now at the verge of entering this so-called promised land which God promised for them, right? And at this point in time, their leader is Joshua. Moses, in these 40 years, he passed away. It took so long, Moses actually passed away. And the right now leader is Joshua, and he's leading these people. They're on the verge of actually entering this land which God has promised, right? To understand this a little better, for the past 40 years, God's chosen nation, Israel, have been a bunch of wandering refugees, probably like Syria of the present day, right? The only difference is these were not just any refugees. These were really powerful because God was with them from their exit of Egypt up until this point where they're entering this promised land, which is called Canaan, right? This journey is sandwiched between two amazing miracles. We probably know these. How many of us know the parting of the Red Sea? We've heard of it. We've seen it in movies, right? So it's placed between these two amazing miracles. One is parting of the Red Sea, and one is parting of a flood stage Jordan River, right? God has parted these two, and the journey is between these two amazing miracles. And the Lord has defeated a lot of their enemies in between. Enemy territories, which are much powerful than these guys. These guys are a bunch of refugees. I mean, do you really expect these guys who live in a wilderness to fight these fortified cities and win these battles? No, it was God, and he won supernaturally for these guys. Not only that, he provided food and water for every day through these 40 years that their journey was in this wilderness. Right? And the word about them spread through the entire region, right? Imagine without even the electronic media, their word spread and everyone was trembling. Imagine actually these guys, if they had social media, the whole world would have gone bizarre. Like, imagine these guys actually doing a Facebook Live of the Red Sea parting. Like, everyone's like, bro, this is real. This is just happening right now. I mean, they would have lined up for selfies, dude. Like, what a background. How really cool that would have been. The whole world would be talking about it. And the whole world was terrified. Now they're almost about to touch down on this land that was promised to them. There were already people living in this land. This land was not empty. There were already people living in this land. But God promised to Israel that he will give them this land. Now they're about to do it. But their first battle is against a well-fortified, impenetrable Jericho as their first city to conquer. They probably had a great wall of China around them. It was impenetrable in those days to conquer this city. And this is where we find our passage for today. And this is a small passage in a huge saga of events. And we'll be taking help of a few other texts which will help us in understanding this picture better. So I've broken this text down into two parts, and let's dive straight into the first half as we start. as Joshua, the son of Nun, it is Nun. He is the son of somebody, right? He's not son of Nun. Joshua, the son of Nun, sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. And they went and came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab and lodged there. Many questions springing up. And it was told to the king of Jericho, behold, men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land. Then the king of Jericho sent to Rahab saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land. But the woman had taken these two men and hidden them. And she said, true, the men came to me, but I did not know where they are from. And when the gate was about to be closed at dark, the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof and hid them with the stalks of flax, which are certain plants. And it was a harvest season, so they've just harvested them. And she's put them on the terrace, on the roof. So the men pursued after them on the way to the Jordan as far as the fords. And the gate was shut as soon as the pursuers had gone out. Like my previous talk, if you remember, our main character is again not a follower of the God of the Bible. Always have people who don't know Jesus or probably who don't consider him God, who are just here for the community, and we are totally cool with it. And this is the main character of the story. She's not a follower of Jesus. And from what we see, she's also definitely not one of the best women we can find in the Bible. Right? The Bible is actually very candid in describing her as a prostitute. She's mentioned four times in the Bible, and thrice she's mentioned as Rahab the prostitute, Rahab the harlot, Rahab the prostitute. So it's almost like this name is synonymous to this. I mean, three times in the Bible she's mentioned as the prostitute. So let's look into her life and see what we can learn about fear and faith. So that's why I titled my talk as The Fear Factor. The narrative for my three-point talk this morning will actually flow like this. I do not know. Second is, I know. The third thing is, do you know? Right? Let's flow into the first point straight. I do not know. The passage does start off with a blatant lie. Rahab refuses to have any knowledge of these men, where they are from, where they are now, nothing. She simply says, I do not know. She even misguides the king's men to go searching after them. And we later on go on to see how, because of this life, the spies were saved, and eventually she was saved herself. I struggle with this question, and many theologians and thinkers have grappled with this question. Does the Bible support lying when the intention is good? Does the Bible support lying when the intention is good? If you're not a follower of Jesus and you have this objection with the Bible and the God of the Bible, we struggled with the question too. And this morning, allow me to try and answer this question. The Bible never commends lying. It has never commended lying. Even though Rahab was commended in the New Testament, the part after Jesus, she was commended twice. These two times she was commended for having faith, which resulted in an action, not for lying. Let's add, the Bible says, prompted by faith, Rahab the prostitute, here you go, Rahab the prostitute, was not destroyed along with those who refused to believe and obey, because she had received the spies in peace without enmity. There's one more verse which says, the same with Rahab the Jericho harlot. Wasn't her action in hiding God's spies and helping them escape, that seamless unity of believing and doing, what counted with God? They are not commending her for her lying, commending her for her faith in this foreign God. But let's see what the Bible actually does say about lying. It says, lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but those who deal faithfully are his delight. In other words, a false witness will not go unpunished, and he who tells lies will perish. In fact, the Bible calls Satan as the father of lies and attributes all the lies to him. It says, he was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. In my experience, most of my lying was in response to fear. Let's see what Rahab did here. Literally, she was trying to save her life. From what's been happening in the past 40 years, battle after battle, miracle after miracle, fear was gripping these people slowly but steadily. And now she was sitting on not just one, but two ducks who could lay golden eggs for her for the rest of her life. She knew if she saved these people, her rest of the life is sorted. She's saved forever. And she can strike a deal if she saved these guys. And in the light of all of this fear and this golden opportunity, she does resort to lying. Isn't this familiar to us? I mean, in our homes, leave alone lying as a kid. Even to this day, on my off day when my mom calls me in the morning, she calls me to check if I had breakfast or no. How will I wake up for breakfast? Like, seriously. I wake up around 11:30, she calls me, did you have breakfast? My answer is, I did. Because I'm afraid it'll go into a morning lecture on an off day, which I definitely don't want. So I lied. I mean, my lies are most of these times, these are not blatant lies. It's a very crafty interpretation of the truth which won't hurt anyone. Right? Do you relate to me? In our work, we always got to stay with, in the book, good books of our bosses, right? I remember when I was working for my previous company, in the lunchtime, I would go drive home for lunch. And it's not my desk job, right? I was never doing a desk job. So I would drive home for lunch and take a nice afternoon nap. When my boss would call me, I would talk to him about everything, about work, everything, leaving out the fact that I was at home. Later on, I would justify using hands, saying why it is okay. Isn't this familiar to us? The issue we are most defensive about is the sin that we are struggling with the most. The issue that we are most defensive about is the sin that we are struggling with the most. And this is what we lie about the most. It is probably a relationship that is harming us. It is probably a lie in the CV on which we built our whole career. Now we can't do anything about it. It's probably a lie which now everyone believes. Now we'll do anything to just save face. What are we most defensive about in our lives? Let's go back to the passage and see what happens. Believing that lie, the king's men leave in pursuit of these spies. Then Rahab quickly goes up to the roof where she's hidden them and goes on to strike the deal of her life. Much better than any of the deals she struck with any men with regards to her profession before. Let's dig deeper into Rahab's fear in my second point, I know. Let's dive into the second half of the text for today. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to them that the Lord has given you the land and that the fear of you has fallen upon us. And that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt. And what you did to the two kings of the Amorites, which was an enemy nation, who were beyond the Jordan. To Sihon and Og, whom you literally devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard it, our heart, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. They were trembling with fear. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and God on earth. If we carefully see, what Rahab is actually scared of is not these Israelites. she's actually scared of the Lord of the Israelites who was doing these amazing things for them. Overturning kingdoms, parting seas, everything in order. He left no stone unturned for them to come to this point to conquer this kingdom. She's seen this for the past 40 years and she's realized there is no stopping these guys. There is no stopping whatsoever. So she says, I know of this Lord who is powerful, supernatural, and mighty in battle. And she was scared of him. To give us a little more context, the God of the Israel was giving this land to the nation, not by letting them coexist with these people who are already living there. He was giving this promised land by wiping out everyone who was living in that land. Let's see what the Bible says. When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you are entering to possess, and he plucked away many nations before you, the Hittites, Girgashites, and the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. All of them are parasites, dude. Like seven nations greater and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you smite them, then you must utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them or show no mercy to them. Why was God doing so? If you are not a follower of Jesus, I know one of the major objections to the Christian faith has been this God who is in the Old Testament. He's a God of bloodshed and cruelty. How can we even consider him God? You know, Mahatma Gandhi, our father of the nation, he loved Jesus. He liked everything he did. He borrowed ahimsa and all of that from him. But he said, the parts of the Old Testament repelled him. He says, this is the reason why I won't believe in Christianity. Is this Old Testament God really a God of genocide, wiping away nations from the face of the earth? If that's your question today, if that's your objection to believing in this God, let me present my case in two parts. The first part, the Bible records that these lands were filled with sin. Some of them were incest, adultery, child sacrifice, bestiality. For all those who don't know what bestiality is, they were having sex with animals. All of this and more were part of their lifestyle. This was not one-off. This was part of their lifestyle. How could a holy and perfect God ever tolerate this? What about us? What about our judgment? You know, recently we've heard of this Gurgaon rape case where a 19-year-old mother with her 8-month-old baby was fleeing to her in-law's place after a fallout with their neighbors. She is running on that highway, gets into this truck. The truck driver takes her in, stops the truck to her side and starts misbehaving with her. After a point, to save her dignity, she jumps off the truck with her baby. In terror, she runs to these three men who offer to help her. When she runs to them, they offer to help. They were under the influence of alcohol. Once she gets onto their van, they change their mind, take a U-turn, drive to a lonely forest, and rape her one by one at night. Once they finish doing that, they get the baby onto the van. While they were going from the moving van, they threw the baby onto the road. When the mom gains consciousness at 2 a.m. in the morning, she goes to see her baby is not responding, to finally see she's dead. When we hear of cases like this and Nirbhaya, isn't our first response crying for vengeance? Don't we demand death as the only penalty? I remember I cried. I said, they deserve death penalty. I'm pretty sure all of us did. When we with our mortal human judgment are always crying for vengeance, what about this holy God isn't it right or fair on his part for him to cry for judgment? And these people were burning children on the altar. They were having sex with animals for God's sake, and they were incestuous as part of their lifestyle. Therefore, he decided we should completely wipe these people out so that Israelites don't start living and following their lifestyle. I know this issue is still a little unsettling. Promise I will answer this objection and close it in a better way later on in the talk. So Rahab realizes this, though not the moral implications of all of this, she realizes that Jericho is doomed to destruction. She acknowledges and believes this God, and that he is the God of heaven and earth. This is not the belief or the faith that we talk about today. It's not the gospel belief and faith that we're going to talk about later. It's the belief and faith which came out of utter fear and terror of this God. When faced with fear, listen to me carefully. When faced with fear, we can have two responses. We can have only two responses. We either run away from God or we run to God. In this case, Rahab, an outsider to this God, chose to run to God. At this point in time of the story, let me try and bring a very interesting twist in tale. Point you to a story of people who actually ran away from God when faced with fear. You know what? Turns out this is not the first time Israelites have actually sent spies to this promised land. 40 years back, when Moses actually got them out of Egypt, he sent a group of 12 spies into this land. They go spy the land for 40 days and come back with a terrified report of that land. Let's see what the Bible says. But the men who had gone up with him said, "We can't attack these people. They are stronger than we are." And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, "The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there." If you know the story of David and Goliath, Goliath, this giant, is from this tribe. "We seemed like grasshoppers. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them." The same people who are now trembling with fear seemed like giants in those days before 40 years to these guys. You know what the crying shame is? These are the same people who experienced the mighty hand of God in getting them out of Egypt. This is after the Lord parted the Red Sea and they walked on dry ground. Moses sends these spies and they come back with that report of terror. These are insiders like us. In the light of what Rahab the outsider did, what a crying shame. They rather chose to run away from God when faced with fear. This morning, those of us who are followers of Jesus, let me ask you, how are we responding to fear in our lives? Probably the fear of losing your job. Probably the fear of not being able to get a better job and feeling stuck here. I mean, there's cutthroat competition everywhere, starting from the corporate to the arts. I know as musicians and actors how difficult it is to get that one big break. What if we never get that big break? Those of us who are single, is the fear of marriage bothering us? This fear of having to spend your life with a total stranger, probably in the Indian scenario. Are you just thinking, this is not my thing, I can't do this thing, it is too scary for me? Those of us who are married, I know how difficult it is to manage our homes. I mean, leave alone our families, with the increasing costs of living every day, year by year, it is so difficult to manage ourselves, leave alone our families and our kids. I mean, the cost of education has been skyrocketing for the past, I don't know how many years. How are we dealing with these everyday fears? Are we running away from God? Or are we running to God? Going back to the story, we see that these spies actually agree to this deal that Rahab has made. She says, if I protect you, will you save me? And they agree to this deal. They even give her a sign that they will save her. They give her a sign to tie a scarlet cord, which scarlet is red in color, scarlet cord on her window. When they come to destroy the city, they promised her that we will see that cord and we will not touch anyone who lives in that house. Eventually, the Lord gave Jericho and they destroyed. And Joshua, their leader, kept the promise given by these spies in saving her and her family. But the story doesn't end here. This takes me to my last point. And I promise to tie all the loose ends that I've left previously and answer that major objection that we have to this God. In my last point, do you know? If you've been engaging with us for any length of time, you'll know that anything we do at New City, everything that we do at New City is about Jesus. So is this talk. You know, this passage gives us at least three pointers to Jesus. Firstly, Rahab was not only saved. Listen to me carefully. Rahab, the prostitute, who she's mentioned thrice as a prostitute in the Bible, was not only saved. She ends up marrying a guy from this tribe called Judah. Rahab and this guy end up being the great-great-grandparents of the King David, from whose line perfect and sinless Jesus came. If you've been following our recent the ongoing series, The Grace and Flaws, we've been tracing the bloodline of Jesus. We've seen how Jesus included sinful people, sinful messed up people like Rahab in his bloodline. This gives us a lot of hope, doesn't it? That is the first way we can go to Jesus. Secondly, the scarlet cord that these guys gave as a sign to Rahab is a pointer to Jesus' blood. You know what happened in Egypt? When God was actually dealing with these guys, he sent an angel of death to destroy all the firstborn living in Egypt. But to all the Israelites being there, he said, sacrifice a pure lamb and apply its blood on your doorposts, so that when the angel of death passes, he knows that it is an Israelite and passes by without destroying you. That same blood which was on the doorpost of the Israelites in Egypt, to this red scarlet cord which is on the window of Rahab, all these are pointers to the ultimate blood of Jesus by which all of us are saved. That is the second way we can point to Jesus. But allow me to point Jesus in the third way, which I carefully, prayerfully picked. This is the path of fear and terror. You must be wondering that if I'm asking you to respond to terror and fear, how different is this God from any militant or terrorist organization, from whatever they're doing in the present day? How different is this God if you have to respond to terror and fear? This, my friends, is where the Christian faith stands in stark contrast. I'm not asking you to respond to the terror or the wrath of God. Listen to me carefully. I'm not asking you to respond to the terror or the wrath of God. But I'm asking you to respond to the cross, where the terror and wrath of God were satisfied. I'll also make my last attempt in resting that objection. When we in our sinfulness are actually crying for judgments of death when faced with atrocious sins, it is only fair for this holy and perfect God to cry vengeance and say, I demand death. God would cease to be God if he was not for this fair judgment. In his perfect standard of holiness, even our lying is as worse as probably adultery and incest. He is way perfect. And if in our messed up standards of judgment, if we are crying for death for these people, in his perfect standard, even lying is as terrible as that. So Lord, you would have to wipe away the entire human race from the face of the earth. Dude, that is genocide taken to the ultimate level. That is only fair that he wipes out human race from the face of the earth. But what he did here is something very interesting and something we can spend our lifetimes pondering upon. He sent his perfect son Jesus, the greater Joshua. Joshua in Hebrew means Jesus. He sends Jesus, the greater Joshua, not to come and destroy this world, but actually take the entire weight of our sin on him, right from our lying, our adultery, our incest, our bestiality, everything horrible on this perfect Jesus. The Bible is very graphic in saying he not only took our sin, he became sin for us. He became sin to such an extent that his own father wasn't able to look at him. Did you ever feel like that with your kids? Is it even possible to not be able to look at your son because he's so messed up, so sinful? Did you ever feel like that? It is impossible. Jesus, the son, was betrayed by his father. Sorry, he was forsaken by his father. His father turned his face away. So instead of destroying this entire world, the father destroyed him. He killed him. He bled and he died. And his perfect life was gifted to the entire mankind for those who believe like Rahab did. You know, when the father looks at us now, he doesn't look at a lying cheat or a deceiving Felix. He looks as if I've never done anything wrong before. And that's the case with all of us who believe in his son and what he's done for us on that cross. He has promised us a land as well. He has promised us a land, not in this world full of sin, but a perfect place devoid of any sin, to dwell with him. You see, the cross is not just an epitome of God's love. The cross is not just an epitome of God's love, but his ultimate fury. The moment we stop seeing that and see cross is just love and not God's terror and fury, we will make Jesus a teddy bear God. I mean, we want to play with him. We will never take him seriously. The cross is an epitome of God's terror and fury, which was met in Jesus. Eric Raymond said these profound words: "We are saved from God, the Father's fury, by God, by Jesus' sacrifice, and for God, so that we can become a delight to him instead of disgusting him." What we are ultimately saved from is God himself, his wrath and his terror. Jesus saved us from it by willing to come and die for us. Those of us who are not yet followers of Jesus, can we relate to Rahab here in the light of the fear that she faced? She responded with faith in God. Most of us are probably in the same place like Rahab. Our careers are not satisfying us, clearly. Our past is probably haunting us. And our future probably seems like it is all out there to get us. Can we look to Jesus this morning as Rahab did? Those of us who've been tasting Jesus' love for a while now and seeing how different he is from anything and everything that we know of, but are still afraid to put our faith completely in him. Or probably we are at a stage where we believe that he is God, but are not able to express it in action like Rahab did in providing refuge to these spies. In the light of what Rahab did, we have hope to express faith in action. Face our fears and express faith in action. Those of us who are followers of Jesus, is our faith often being replaced by fear? Are our past experiences of God's supernatural interventions still failing to deepen our trust and faith when we are faced with fear in the present? What is our response to these fears? Friends, no matter where you are in your journey with Jesus, let me assure you, since Jesus took our place on the cross, we can replace our fears by faith in him. We can replace our fears by faith in him. So this morning, I'd like to give you some time to respond. No matter where your journey is, probably you don't care about this God. It's fair. It's totally fair. Probably you've been tasting him for a while, experiencing his goodness, but are afraid to put your faith completely in him. Probably you believe in him, but you're not able to express it when the situation demands. Or probably you know everything about him. You believed in him from your childhood. But when the rubber hits the road, we are still running away from God. If this is you this morning, let me assure you, because of what Jesus did for us on the cross, our fears can be replaced by faith in him.